I just want to know one thing. How many of you turned on your heaters last night? That would be me and my wife, for sure. Well, it's still a great time to be here. It's, even though it's a little bit chilly today, it's verdandit. This is my favorite time of year when everything is green and fresh and new. I know some of you like the autumn, but I'm a spring person, particularly Indianapolis 500 people, and our grievous apologies to Mr. Creech for not letting him know the unusual behavioral qualities of the people of the city of Indianapolis during this time. It only gets better. I'd like to talk today a little bit about a spiritual superpower that we sometimes don't consider to be a superpower, but has an amazing effect. I was very grateful to see the very fine and useful and in-depth other prior message from Mr. Cobb, and it's amazing how these things work together, so hopefully we'll see that happen here. And I will see if this technology piece works for me. Aha! This is my obligatory cat photo for the social media folks, but also it does illustrate a little bit, and you see the cat on top of the bullet train. Those of you who saw this a couple of months ago, that cat crawled up on top of a multi-million dollar train and delayed it for 6 hours. They couldn't get the cat off because of the fact that they had all kinds of really high voltage infrastructure above it, and it took quite a while. But there will be a connection, as you'll see. When we meet a person for the first time, an amazing thing happens. Your brain, when you see somebody for the very first time, will deliberately analyze and characterize the facial features of that person. Your brain will make near instant value judgments. If they're physically attractive, they get positive points. Based on their perceived age, they get categorized as nice to know, follow up because they might be interested, or see you later. And based on what they're wearing or how they present themselves, your brain will categorize themselves into whether or not they fit your taste in clothes and appearance. You come up with 1,000 different little things in that 1/10 of a second going on that makes you wonder whether you might like it. You can end up thinking that you're not going to like them at all. When that person speaks and you react, your brain analyzes those speech patterns and topical discourse, confirming or shifting those initial perceptions. So within 7 seconds, you form a near permanent, what is called a first impression. And that first impression will last a great deal of time. You'll walk away from that first impression thinking, I'd like to get to know that person better. What a nice experience. I hope we meet again. But wow, what was wrong with him or her? I'm glad that didn't last long. Later when we're asked, when you think somebody says, what did you think of so-and-so, you will have a definite opinion, whether it's right or whether it's wrong. So hence the phrase, one only gets one chance to make a first impression. This has been documented by Princeton Research and many, many times since, so it's something to consider. And the superpower we're going to talk about today can help us make a better first impression, but also make a lasting impression. Allow me to relay an example of how this works. A few years ago, I went to a community meeting. I never attended this particular community meeting, for which the dress code was casual. I was running a little late, so I didn't bother to go home and change into casual clothes. I wore a suit and tie. And as I sat and the meeting progressed, and they were talking about various topics, I noticed somebody scowling at me. I'd never seen this person before, and I thought, what did I do to you? You know, and it was obvious that he had something going on. And so after a while, the community ran into some topics, and they asked for some response, and I happened to have a particular response, and I spoke. When I happened to glance over at this person again, expecting to see him really want to take a bite out of my leg or something, he was looking really sheepish. I thought, oh, okay, well, looks like we ran the whole gamut there. So after the meeting, he came up to me and said he wanted to apologize, which was even more unusual. And he said that when I came in wearing a suit, he was absolutely convinced that I was a lawyer. And he happened to have a friend in a room who was having some legal issues, and he just absolutely knew that in my pocket I had a subpoena or a court arrest warrant for his friend And he was thinking of all the terrible things he was going to do to me to stop me from delivering that subpoena. So he sat there for 20 minutes and thought all kinds of terrible things. And then I spoke. And then he realized, boy, I got this wrong. So it happens in the most unlikely of situations. Every day we fashion judgments, and every day we are judged, and there's a superpower we can use to make sure we come across in the right way, and also that we have the right relationships ourselves when we meet and talk to people. When we do this, we are pigeonholing people. Humans cannot stand to have undefined data floating around in their head. They have to categorize it, and that's part of the process of what happens. And we don't stop that evaluation and judgment process. It continues nonstop. You're doing it right now. You may be wondering, where is he going with this? Or what's his point? Or I hope he finishes early. In most respects, that's a healthy process. It's especially healthy when our evaluation process is governed by biblical principles and the Holy Spirit. And that's what I'd like to talk about today. Each of us has access to a spiritual superpower that can improve our lives across the board. It's a superpower that God and Jesus Christ expect us to embrace and deploy. And when I talk about it, and you'll see what it is in a moment, it's dangerous for somebody like me to talk about it because now you can call me out when you say, remember that sermon you gave? Split sermon? What's that all about? Because we all tend to evaluate each other, and now by saying this, I can be evaluated. But we're actually given the choice of whether we want to use this superpower. But if we're in a relationship with God the Father and Jesus Christ, there's an expectation. God will eventually require us to use it if we don't positively embrace it. But it does have incredible benefits. So what am I talking about? I'm talking about the superpower of humility. I grew up in politics where a lot of people weren't very humble at all. And so that's why it gives me a little pause and makes me a little nervous to talk about it. But it's something that I have been seeing and in my own life and the need to grow, and I would like to share some of that with you today. And I'm grateful as I look out here that nobody's rolling their eyes. And I invite you humbly to hear me out. It's very important to understand that humility, especially biblical humility, is often misunderstood or even poorly defined. The biblical concept of being meek, which is also misunderstood and or poorly defined, is directly related. Some make the mistake of assuming that when one practices humility or is meek, they must be small-voiced, timid. I say introvert. There's nothing wrong with being an introvert, but sometimes they don't want to speak out. You want to be not seen, and you want to just be a little small voice. That's not humility at all. It can be attributes of a person who is humble, but that's not the definition. We read in Numbers 12:13 that the man Moses was very meek in the King James above all men who were on the face of the earth. The New King James Version translates that to be slightly different. It says that he was more humble than any person on the earth. But when you read the accounts of Moses and what he did and how he stood, and we saw some of that reflected in Mr. Cobb's sermon about how he was a powerful leader. He spoke out powerfully. He declared the works of God. He wasn't afraid, but yet he was the most humble of all the people on the earth. What is interesting about that is most of you have heard of a guy named, a business professional named Jim Collins. Jim Collins is a business professional, is widely read. You probably heard of his book, Good to Great, and a number of other books. And he talks about humility is the X factor of great leadership. Most companies prefer humble leaders as opposed to brash, outspoken people who thunder lightning and are hard to deal with. What does practicing humility mean in that context? And what is that X factor? As I mentioned in the business world, some falsely assume that an egocentric, brash leader like Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, Nancy Pelosi, or now past age, Lee Iacocca, are the best person for the job. People say, we want somebody who crushes things. We want somebody who destroys the opposition, who massacres and creates fear wherever he or she goes. But as we'll see, arrogant leaders are not preferred. although they make great news stories. Egocentric and arrogant leaders typically use fear and anger to get things done. Jobs was especially noted at Apple for his arrogance and his autocratic leadership. Apple executives often talk today about how they both loved him and they hated him. Jobs was hard to work for. He could be unbelievably nasty, even cursing employees. And he created it he got away with it because of his recognized genius for design and functionality. He drove people to higher heights. He created a concept that is called today the Jobs Reality Distortion Field, where he would talk about things that didn't exist as if they did and inspire people to go for it. But he was one in a generation. He is not a preferred style. So obviously, humility represents the exact opposite of this arrogance. But there's more. And here are some principles. Humble people in today's world, when they practice humility, they have a right-sized perception of themselves. They understand their strengths and they know their weaknesses. They don't think that they're greater than they really are. They don't try to be something they're not. They're comfortable with who they are. Humble people, that's the happy dupe slide there, sorry. Humble people, especially humble leaders, appreciate and understand that they are not the smartest person in the room, and they don't have to be. They're there to collectively get a job done with their team. Humble people and humble leaders encourage others to speak up and listen, and they listen to what they have to say. They encourage people to respect that many points of view exist. Humble people embrace and champion the best ideas from that, even when they may have not have personally thought of them, or the ideas may be different from what they thought originally they perceived. Humble leaders are team-focused. They inspire and empower through their examples. They are willing to be vulnerable. They are willing to accept constructive feedback. When things go wrong, humble people readily admit to their mistakes and take responsibility. They work to make themselves better. They share credit, as you saw. I'd like to relate a story from history about that. As you know, I'm a huge fan of General George C. Marshall. He was a remarkable human being. Churchill said he's the man who won the war in World War II. But you don't hear a lot about him today because he refused to write a book about his experiences. He was a very humble man. He only reluctantly take interviews so somebody could write a biography about him. But if you ever happen to read a biography about him, you'll see how remarkable this individual was his entire life. In his 20s, when he was a lieutenant and he was stuck in China, what did he do? He learned how to speak Mandarin. How incredibly important was that later when he was the presidential envoy to China from President Truman? Who knew? But the story I want to tell you about very briefly is that during World War I, he did a lot of great things and attracted a lot of attention, not seeking to be promoted or elevated, but he ended up on the general staff. He was in the commanding circle by virtue of the fact that he stood up and spoke his mind when things were appropriate, even at great personal risk. And his compatriot, General George MacArthur, who was very flamboyant, wore capes and had a sword and had his own pistol types and everything, who was known to be very egocentric, he ran all over everybody, including Marshall. Marshall never retaliated, even when he had the capacity. So my point is, and later on in World War II, when he became Army Chief of Staff, he was working out of Washington, he sent out a message when the Japanese were imminently going to invade Pearl Harbor. And one of the messages was to the Philippines, where MacArthur was stationed. And it said, we have dozens of these B-17 world-class bombers. Get them off the runways because they're going to get bombed. And MacArthur was at a party and had orders not to be disturbed. And so the Japanese destroyed every single bomber. It set back the United States and Asia by at least a year. And so later, MacArthur had to flee the Philippines, and there's all kinds of controversies about that that I won't go into for time. And Marshall had every right to discipline himself. But it was war, and it was time for leadership, and it was time for people to pull together. So Marshall ends up in Australia after, some of you may know this story. He ends up in Australia and he calls a big meeting at, and he tells MacArthur he's got to be there. So MacArthur, who used to be, Marshall's head, in fact, he exiled Marshall to become the head of the National Guard in Illinois prior to World War II, which actually ended up being an incredible experience for Marshall. But it also was a slight. It was a deliberate slight. So now the tables are turned. Marshall's in charge. And MacArthur's his subordinate. So what happens? So at this meeting, Marshall calls MacArthur up. MacArthur's thinking he's going to get chewed out publicly for not running the show better in the Philippines. And MacArthur himself had been overlooked for honors during World War I for a variety of reasons, one of them being that he was so flamboyant and he kind of irritated people. So he had his own little bone to pick. But here was Marshall. Marshall had a chance to really set it right. So what did Marshall do? Marshall gave him the Medal of Honor for valor in World War I that was justly deserved. MacArthur was absolutely shocked. And from that day on, the hatchet was buried, and the two men worked very closely together. Marshall wanted to be commander of Operation Warlord in World War II. It was his to take. They were in Africa meeting with Stalin and Churchill. Stalin demanded to know who was going to be the man who was going to take over and command Operation Warlord. And so Roosevelt met with Marshall and he said, "General, obviously this is yours. And what do you want to do?" This is Marshall's crucial moment. His whole career he's prepared for. Marshall says, "What would you have me to do, Mr. President?" And the president replied, "I can't sleep at night knowing you aren't in Washington, D.C. Marshall said, "You made your decision, Mr. President. Eisenhower it is." And never said another word. But what he did do is he wrote the orders himself and sent them that named Eisenhower Operation Overlord head. And then the next day, he went to the radio shack and retrieved the orders, packaged them up, and sent them to Eisenhower and says, "I thought you might like this as a memento." His subordinate became the head of the job he wanted, and he never mentioned it again. That's humility of a high nature. So let me get back into the biblical piece of this. And sorry for the digression. That one really affects me. There are lots of human rewards, as we saw. Marshall just went through that for practicing humility. But there are biblical rewards that have much higher degree. When we fully embrace being humble or meek, and we embrace the spiritual superpower, it will transform our lives. So to underscore this, let me quickly go through a couple of questions. Have you ever thought about actively opposing God? I mean, literally. Could you do something on the other side that you could embrace an attitude that would attract the direct positive attention of God himself? What's that mean for us? Let's look at these questions and let's see how we can deploy this biblical side of the humility. First James, we read, "Clothe yourselves," all of us, an interesting metaphor there, "with humility toward one another, because why? God opposes the proud." So if you choose not to embrace this, then you may find yourself in opposition. So it's something to think about. James says the same thing in chapter 4, verse 6. That might underscore how important that is. So we don't want to set ourselves up to attract opposition from the God of the universe. And that's especially true for us who believe. It's a warning. So as I mentioned, this gives me pause when I speak about this, because this is a picture of what I would deserve if I got what was coming to me in my life. I've said this before, but it's true. Paul writes in Romans 3, verse 23, that all have sinned, and I fall into that category. And I suspect others do as well. So it's a good thing that we have the option to be humble and receive that grace, to be right-sized. And when we do this, then we do receive grace. It means we're not in any danger at all of being in opposition and having God oppose us. We find ourselves in a position where we are going to receive favor. That verse that is paraphrased both in James and 1 Peter is in Proverbs 3:34. God toward the scorners is scornful. That's not a good thing to have the power of the universe scornful towards you. But to the humble, he gives favor. Second question is, who is the greatest? Because that's what we think when we do something that we don't seek recognition for. That's what we're against. That's not a common thing in human nature. We find this passage that we typically read just for the annual blessings of the little children. It includes positive direction that we should think about daily. So let's turn to Matthew 18, verse 1. You know all about this. This is a familiar verse, Matthew 18, verse 1. And we read, at that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? That's a typical human response. I hear it a lot from some of my clients. I hear it from people I work with. Who's going to be on top? Maybe you've heard that from yourself. Maybe you heard that in your family. Who's going to be the greatest? Who's going to tell us what to do? What's that hierarchy look like? Let's read on in verse 2. Calling them a child, he put them in the midst of them. So this probably didn't make any sense at all to these disciples. What's he doing? What does this child have to do with it? Who is the greatest? But then it gets very serious. In verse 3, Jesus lays it out. Truly I say to you, unless you turn, this means to be converted, changed, or transformed, and become like children, humble, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. So what did he say to do? Whoever humbles himself like this child will be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. So that puts it in perspective. So what's a child look like? What's a positive attribute? Unassuming, unpretentious, happy, filled with wonder, kind, loving, quick to forgive, caring, forgetful. Absolute joy to be around when a child is in wonderment, isn't it? That's what we're supposed to be like. Sounds like 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient, kind, not envious, not rude. Doesn't insist on its own way. It's not resentful. It rejoices in true things. Believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. So ask ourselves, do we exhibit these qualities? Because they're directly tied to humility. Here's another dimension. Jesus said, I came to earth not to be served, but to serve. He said, he who humbles himself in service will be exalted. And finally, the parallel piece, when you humble yourself, then God himself will exalt you. Do we believe that? Here's another aspect. James, the human brother of Jesus, he was the oldest brother of Jesus Christ. What title did he take? Sometimes you read that people call themselves apostles, or I was called by God, not by man. They make very strong statements. James had an unusual situation. In 1 Corinthians 15, verse 7, it says, Paul writes that Jesus had a special one-on-one meeting with James. Wouldn't you like to have been there and heard that? So, what did he call himself after all that? He takes one title, and one title only. Servant. James 1, verse 1. A servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ. That word servant is doulos, which is a politically charged word today. It's not politically correct. It is literally translated slave. So, translators dance around and tiptoe around that one because they want to make sure that people understand it's not talking about 19th century slavery. It's very important. But nonetheless, it means bondservant. It means a total commitment to the service of God in Jesus Christ. It means we yield ourselves and we say, thy will be done, and we are totally willing to do that. We put God first. Now, the third question, which I didn't really talk about, but if you could do something and embrace an attitude that would attract God's positive presence, what would that be? Well, we read the answer, of course, in a very familiar verse. Isaiah 66, verse 2. This is the one to whom I will look. And we read right over that sometimes, but that means we are attracting God's direct attention. God is aware of who we are. When we are humble, contrite in spirit, teachable, meldable, willing to yield, and trembles, respects deeply the word of God. So you want to attract the direct attention of God? I do. So that means embrace and deploy that spiritual superpower of humility. And again, when you are doing that and attracting God's attention in a good way, then sometimes you'll find yourself in an amazing position. I've seen that in this past year. My wife and I have been where you find yourself in a position of favor that you don't deserve and you didn't anticipate. So in the time remaining, I want to introduce another special blessing, a physical one. We have medical professionals here, so I have to be careful. But I will say this generally. We have a number of chemicals and peptides and different hormones that circulate in our bodies. We are essentially chemical beings in many respects. We wish sometimes we were purely cognitive, but we're not. And these chemicals can affect us directly. For example, when you drink alcohol, you feel a feeling of euphoria. After one drink, alcohol is absorbed, passes the brain barrier, stimulates the production of dopamine. Too much alcohol, you have frontal lobe issues, whether you want them or not. So these things happen. But there are other peptides and neurotransmitters that affect feelings, clarity of mind, performance, and I've talked about some of those in the past, including cortisol, which is the stress hormone, which we've all gotten familiar with in the past year, I submit. But there's one that has to deal with humility, one you may not have concerned. It comes from the hormone peptide called oxytocin. Anybody heard of oxytocin? It's not oxycodone. Not talking about the same thing. Oxycodone is for very special occasions, not for typical use. But it's produced from the pituitary gland in the back of your head, in the hypothalamus. It is critical during childbirth because it helps the mother both prepare and go through childbirth and then recover. Helps with bonding, affects our emotional system deeply. But beyond that, it has a very big role in males and females. It is rightly called the love hormone, the empathy hormone, the trust hormone. It is also called the hug hormone. And the absence of that obviously explains why some of us are a little frayed around the edges, because we get this when we hug people. It enables the body and mind to respond to a variety of stressful situations. So when you get oxycodone, you have feelings of trust, of friendship, of love. So why do we care about that? Well, I just killed it. Aha. It's most people's favorite. Like I say, it produces friendship and empathy and good things. But when we do good works, when we are generous, we also get a surge of oxycodone. You ever see something good on social media where there's a really poignant story about somebody helping somebody? That's oxycodone in your head. When you share that and like it, you get a surge just for seeing it. So I submit to you that I believe that that is a gift of God. And it's a physical reward to reinforce it. So what about the power of words and humility? Well, you could give another message about that. Our words reflect our status of humility. We can have the best intentions and say the wrong thing. James really warns us about this. But the key point is, humble people build people up. Humble people refrain from judging and talking about other people in negative ways. They speak life into words. James warns us that we have the capacity of staining the whole body and setting on fire the entire course of life with the wrong words. So you have to be careful. We have to try to make sure that our words reflect the glory of God and that we are encouraging and that we are keeping up with what we need to be saying. Why? Well, Jesus himself said that our words will condemn us or they will justify us. And they remain on there. And of course, they're forgiven, but words have long-lasting issues. So society wants us to do this. Society wants us to puff ourselves up. Society wants us not to be humble, but to be arrogant. Society wants us to crush things. They want us to destroy things. But that's not the godly way. The godly way is to encourage, to build up, to express love in our words and our thoughts and our actions. So to wrap things up here a little bit, I would like to consider Micah chapter 6, the famous verse that's on 1,000,000 plaques all around the world, probably underlined in your Bible with good reason. Micah ends up with the answer of a question of how do we please God? How do we have a relationship with God? And he asks some rhetorical questions. He says, would God be pleased with thousands of rams? Would he be pleased with thousands of rivers of oil poured out in the ground? He asks if God would be pleased if we gave up our firstborn, which is an amazing thought, much like Isaac. So what does he come up with? Well, you know the answer. He has told you, O man, what is good and what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, three things, to love mercy, to walk humbly before your God. The word-for-word translation of the English Standard Version renders a little differently. It says, he has told you, O man, what is good and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness. It's also steadfast love is the same word. And to walk humbly. There's activity there. When this verse is talked about, usually we focus on these three things, but I'd like to leave you with a couple of thoughts. The word require is a very unusual word. You'd think that word would be used in front of things like the Ten Commandments or the Shema, hear, O Lord, the Lord our God is one. But here, it's used in a different way. The word is Hebrew, Strong's H1875. And it is pronounced Darash in transliteration. Appears 84 times. It is mostly translated seek. It is sometimes translated inquire or search. Only 12 times is it translated require. So I thought when I went and researched this and found the word require here holds a deeper dimension that's related directly to humility. It's describing how to seek a pathway to develop an active relationship with God. It's part of this seeking, the part of a defining of a personal relationship. It has to do with yielding and embracing active humility. We have seen already the possibilities in being in an active relationship with a being whose power we cannot comprehend. It's so powerful. There's a strong implication of understanding and having deep respect. So as we close, let's take away the fact that many divine promises are activated when we choose, however imperfectly, to embrace and practice humility. The act of understanding that we are the very children of God and that we are in a family and that we have a Father who cares for us. When we practice humility, even in a world that cherishes social standing and spends billions of dollars touting lifestyles, we don't have to worry about that. We can overcome an ungodly, self-centered way of life. Humility, embracing that, allows us to defeat it and overcome it. We receive physical blessings that help us reinforce behavior toward God and others. And we read in James critical things like how to speak life into our words and not tear down. Because mercy triumphs over judgment. So I ask you in conclusion, what if we commit to this? What's the promise? What's the unbreakable promise if we say, okay, God, I want to know about humility. I want to know how to lead my life. I want to know how to encourage people. I want to know how to listen to people. I want to know how to empower and inspire by example. Well, we have the right to claim a certain promise, an unbreakable promise that we read in Proverbs chapter 2, verse 4. The reward for humility and fear of the Lord is riches and honor and life. Let us embrace the spiritual superpower, the superpower of humility. And as we see in Revelation chapter 22, 20 verse, may the grace of God be upon us all.